Well, on Sunday mornings, we're reading through the Gospel according to Matthew. We spent the last few months working through the section of the book that runs through chapters 5, 6, and 7. We call that section of the book the Sermon on the Mount. At the beginning of chapter 5, we read that Jesus went up onto the mountain and sat down there. And his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them. And then the rest of chapter 5, and in chapter 6 and 7, Matthew gives us a summary of all that Jesus taught his disciples there on the mountain. That's why we call it the Sermon on the Mount. But then, last week, we thought about the reaction of the people who listened to that sermon, Jesus' disciples. Chapter 7, verse 28. And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching. Why? What was so astonishing about his teaching? Answer: for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. The scribes were the official expert teachers on all matters religious. When people wanted to know what God required of them, how they were to live, it was to the scribes that they turned. You've heard the word rabbi, still used today, an expert teacher whom people trusted to explain God's law and to guide them through life. Well, basically, when Matthew talks about the scribes, he's talking about those rabbis, the respected, recognized, expert religious teachers. But now, these people, the crowds who were there with Jesus on the mountain, they listened to him, and what astonished them was that when he taught them, it was so different from the way that the scribes taught. And what was the great difference? It was that he taught them as one who had authority, one who had personal authority. I explained last week that the way the rabbis, the scribes, taught was this. They spent all their time quoting other people, the teachers who had gone before them. They saw it as their job just to pass on accurately the views of past experts. I gave you some examples of this. If you are here, you'll remember. Nahum the scribe said, "I have received a tradition from Rabbi Measha, who received it from his father, who received it from the Zugoth, who received it from the prophets as a halakha given by Moses from Sinai." And then he goes on to outline what this chain of teachers had said on a particular matter. That was the way the scribes taught. What was important for them was what other people in the past had said, which had been handed down through the generations. They never claimed any personal authority. It's a bit like a PhD student who has to show that he's read everything that other people have written on his chosen subject. So for every page of his thesis, there may be 50 footnotes referencing other people's works. He's not there primarily to innovate. But when Jesus taught, it was so different. I pointed out to you last week that phrase which he used again and again in the Sermon on the Mount. I say to you. It's as if he's saying, whatever other people have said, I'm telling you. And it's me you've got to listen to. He even uses that phrase when he's been quoting from the Old Testament. When he's been quoting the laws God gave to the Israelites through Moses. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. That was one of the Ten Commandments. And whoever murders will be liable to judgment. That was from God's law as well. But I say to you, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. That's another of the Ten Commandments. But I say to you, it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, Jesus talked as if he had the right to interpret, to supplement, or even to overrule the commandments that God had given to the Israelites through Moses. The fact is that he talked as if he himself were God. I showed you last week that when he sat down on that mountain and began to teach his disciples, he was acting out the role of God himself. You know, in the Old Testament, God took his place as king on Mount Sinai. The mountain became God's throne. But now Jesus takes the mountain as his throne. He sits there in God's place. And what gives him the right to do that? What gives him the right to act as God and to talk as God? Well, he made that very clear here in the Sermon on the Mount. He told these people that God was his Father. He claimed to be God's Son. And what that meant was that he was God's equal, that he shared God's nature, that he was God's representative on earth, that he was the king who was to reign over the kingdom that had come down from heaven to earth. God's kingdom. That's the authority that Jesus claimed for himself. And Jesus made it so clear to every one of those people listening that the only way they could be safe was by submitting totally to his authority. They had to believe every word he taught. They had to put every word into practice. If they did, they would be safe forever. And if they didn't, they would face total, final disaster. Remember those words? We read them again this morning with which Jesus finished the Sermon on the Mountain. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it didn't fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rains fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. Jesus made such huge claims for himself. He demanded that people should give total obedience to his words. He gave out shocking commands and said that people must obey them just because it was he who had given them. And Jesus made awesome promises and told people that they could build everything on his promises. And he said, if you listen to my words and if you put them into practice, you are safe. You're safe forever. And if you don't, you're heading for total, final catastrophe. It's a bit different, isn't it, from that the scribes that I quoted to you. Well, so-and-so said this, and he learned it from so-and-so, and he learned it from so-and-so, and he learned it from so-and-so. The scribes talked like what they were. Experts whose only job was to get the facts right. But Jesus spoke with this total authority. This is what he said about himself and his words. You'll find it further on in this gospel, chapter 24, 25, verse 25. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words will never pass away. However much society may change, however much the opinion of the experts may change, whatever new theories may emerge in politics or economics or physics, his words will still be the final, unchanging truth to be believed, trusted, and obeyed and built upon. As I said last week, that doesn't leave us with many options when it comes to assessing Jesus. Someone who talks the way he talked and puts himself forward as the final authority on everything. Well, he may be a con man. There have been other people down through the centuries who have talked as if they were God and demanded that people take every word they say as the final unquestioned truth. And they've talked that way because they wanted to exploit people financially, sexually, or in other ways. They were con men. Well, you've got to ask, was Jesus just another of those people? Well, did he exploit other people? Did he make himself rich at their expense? Did he abuse his followers? Well, if you know the Gospels at all, you know the answers to those questions. The people who watched Jesus close up knew that here was somebody who never exploited anyone. He was willing to live like a slave. He was there to care for everyone he met, whatever the cost to himself. He was a man willing to live a life of total poverty. In the end, he was the man who was willing to lay down his life for others. People accused him of many things, but they never accused him of taking advantage of others. Again, you've got to ask, was he simply mad? Was he suffering from some delusion of grandeur? Was he the ultimate egomaniac? And again, that's not the impression most people are left with when they read the Gospels, when they read the Sermon on the Mount. We talked about this last Sunday night, didn't we? And We'll touch on it again tonight. Just how witty he was, how shrewd, how realistic he was in his assessment of the world and of people. He never comes over as a crazed fanatic. He comes over as the most rational, thoughtful, practically minded, realistic person you could ask to meet. Writing Jesus off as a con man or as an egomaniac just doesn't ring true. But still, we need to know, can we trust him? He makes these huge claims. He speaks with total authority. He tells us that his words are God's words. He tells us to build our lives on his words. Why should we believe him? That's the question Matthew's going to answer for us in the next two chapters of his book, chapters 8 and 9. In these chapters, he's going to tell us about lots of people who encountered Jesus. People who were in all sorts of terrible situations. People who had all sorts of shocking needs. And he's going to show us Jesus rescuing those people, doing impossible things for them, doing miracles. And what we're going to see in so many of those situations is the fact that all Jesus had to do was to speak. His words had the power to transform every situation. His words had the power to rescue all sorts of people. That's the proof that his words really were God's words. Let's read again chapter 8, verse 1. When he came down from the mountain, after he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. Can you see the picture? Matthew's describing the days, the weeks, maybe the months after Jesus had held that great open-air teaching session on the mountain. He says that great crowds followed him during that period of time. My guess is this, that the people who'd been there with Jesus on the mountain, his disciples, after they came down, must have told so many other people about the things Jesus had been saying, the extraordinary claims he'd made, the way he talked about God as his Father, the shocking commands Jesus had given. Perhaps they told others about that last jaw-dropping parable, his declaration that his words were the rock on which every single one of them had to build their life. And people who heard these things secondhand, they were amazed. And they wanted to know more. So wherever Jesus went, says Matthew, huge crowds followed him. And the question the people were asking was this, can we believe him? He's saying that his words are that important, that reliable, that his words carry total authority. But can we believe him? Well, now listen. And behold, look, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, Lord, if you will, if you're willing to, you can make me clean. And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I will. Be clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. Let's try and see the scene. Here's Jesus. And there's this huge crowd of people gathered around him, listening as Jesus speaks. And then they hear a noise. It's somebody shouting. One word over and over again. Unclean! Unclean! And they look at one another. And you can see the dismay. You can see the horror on their faces. Why? Because that cry tells them that there's a leper approaching. Matthew doesn't mention his cry, but that was the law of the land, that a leper, whenever he approached, had to shout out the word unclean as he came to warn people that he was approaching. He knew that somebody with leprosy was approaching, the most dreadful disease that anyone could have in Bible times. When you meet the word leprosy or leper in the Bible, it's not the same as the illness we call leprosy today. Today, when people use the word leprosy, they're talking about a particular medical condition called Hansen's disease, which is a serious but manageable condition. But the word that's translated in our Bibles as leprosy isn't Hansen's disease particularly. It covers a whole range of skin diseases. The only thing they really have in common is that the symptoms aren't just on the surface. Rather, they break up the skin. They cause open wounds, or they leave raw flesh. They penetrate the skin. You'll find, if you're interested, a catalogue of different types of leprosy in Leviticus chapter 13, which is part of the law that was given to the Israelites by God through Moses. And it was made clear in God's law that leprosy, this range of skin diseases, was different from other illnesses. In what way? Well, anyone who had leprosy was counted as unclean. What that meant was not that they were unhygienic or infectious. Don't think in those terms. It meant that they were carrying in their bodies a sign of the fallenness of this world. The fact that this is a damaged world. The fact that this world has been under a curse ever since Adam and Eve, the first human being, sinned. Other diseases would make a person ill. But this disease that broke up people's skin, it was an obvious sign that the image of God had been damaged in them. You could actually see that death was at work in them. They were disintegrating. That's what it meant when you said that someone was unclean. It meant that they were marked by the curse. And that meant that they had to be cut off from other human beings. They'd become untouchables. They couldn't live with other human beings. They couldn't go into a town or a city. They had to wear torn clothes. They had to let their hair hang loose. Whenever they were in sight of people, they had to cover their upper lip. And wherever they went, they had to cry, "Unclean! Unclean!" That was all laid down in the law that God gave to the Israelites through Moses. Nobody would touch a leper. Because if they did, the uncleanness of the leper would be passed on to them. And then they would be unable to join in the normal life of the community. They couldn't mix with other people. They couldn't go into the temple until they'd gone through various rituals and ceremonies to remove the uncleanness from them. How serious the actual disease was could vary from person to person. With one leper, it could become life-threatening. For another, it would just be a minor problem. But more serious than the disease was the uncleanness it brought. The way it cut people off from the community. They became the living dead. Now, do you understand why I say that the people in the crowd would react with dismay when they heard that voice crying, "Unclean"? The thing that's approaching them is defiled, cursed. It's something that carries with it the smell of death. It's something they all shrink away from in horror. Can you see the crowd backing away? An aisle opening in the crowd. And the leper moving down the aisle towards Jesus. In his torn clothes, with his unkempt hair hanging down, and the face cloth pulled over his lip. And on his skin, they can see the dreaded signs, the lesions, the open wounds that make this man unclean. And Jesus stands there, motionless, as this man approaches. And the man is getting closer, until he's only a yard from Jesus. He's close enough for Jesus to touch him. And this man falls on his knees in front of Jesus. And this is what he says, "Lord, Master, if you are willing, you can make me clean." He believes that Jesus has the power, the authority to break the curse that's on him. Not just to take away the illness, but to cancel that uncleanness. To give him back his life. To make him new. And then the crowd gasps. As Jesus stretches out his hand and touches that broken, ruined, cursed man who's kneeling at his feet. How long is it since anyone touched that man? since that man has felt a human hand resting on him. No one else would touch him. If they did, they'd become instantly unclean. But nothing can make Jesus unclean. Nothing can contaminate or defile Jesus, the man in whom dwells all the power, all the holiness, all the life of God. Yes, that man's carrying death in his body. But Jesus is the one in whom is life, the eternal life of God himself. And then Jesus speaks. I will. I am willing. Be clean. And as Jesus speaks that word, the healing and the cleansing power of Jesus flow into that man. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. The leprosy, the disease, was dealt with in that moment. What did the people in the crowd see? They saw his face, his hands, wherever the leprosy had spread. And it was gone! His skin was whole, like the skin of a baby. The sores had vanished. He was well. He was whole. But more than that, says Matthew, he was clean. You need to understand just what Matthew was saying here. Under the law God had given to Israel, there were times when a person who had had leprosy recovered. The symptoms vanished. But that person was still unclean. And he remained unclean until he went to a priest. The priest would examine him from a distance. In Jesus' time, the rule that the scribes had laid down was that the priest shouldn't come closer than 6 feet. But if the priest was satisfied that the disease had gone, then would start a long program of ceremonies and rituals and sacrifices. It took more than a week for that whole program to be completed. And only at the end of that time would the leper become clean again. Only then would he be able to take his place in the community and worship in the tabernacle and rejoin his relatives. But this man, Matthew says, immediately he was cleansed. Jesus' touch, Jesus' word was enough. The moment Jesus spoke that word, be clean, that man was not only healed, he was cleansed. Once again, just as in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' word had overridden the law given through Moses. Moses said, oh, it'll take more than a week for a man, even after he's been healed, to be cleansed. And it'll take sacrifices and ceremonies to do it. Jesus said, be clean now. And that man was clean. Jesus goes on to tell him that he should go to the priest anyway, but not to seek cleansing. He says, go and show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them. He says, let the priest examine you. Let your healing go down in the record. And yes, bring the thanksgiving offering. But remember, you are clean now. Because I say to you, you are clean. And who could argue with Jesus? Can you imagine anyone stepping out of the crowd and saying, but he's not clean yet. He's got to go to the priest first. He's got to get those ceremonies done. if Jesus' word had the power to heal that man, then Jesus' word had the authority to make that man clean. In the original Greek, that phrase, be clean, is just one word. The same one word from Jesus that healed the man, cleansed the man. Jesus' word had total authority. I'm not going to deal now with the instruction that Jesus gave to the ex-leper, that he should say nothing to anyone. It would take too long to explore that this morning. I want us to focus, to keep our minds focused on the really vital thing we see here in this passage. That when Jesus speaks, his words carry all the power, all the authority of God. They are God's words. The words of this man Jesus roll back the forces of evil. They defeat the curse. They counter death itself. We're not told how this leper learned about Jesus. Cut off from ordinary people, isolated from the community. How did the news about Jesus reach him? We don't know. But it is extraordinary how news does travel, particularly in country places, even to people who seem cut off from normal channels of communication. One way or another, this man had heard about Jesus. He'd heard about the miracles Jesus had done in healing others. He'd heard about what Jesus claimed for himself. And this man believed it. When he comes to Jesus, he's already convinced of Jesus' power and authority. What does he do? He kneels before Jesus. What does he call Jesus? Lord. He acknowledges that the carpenter from Nazareth is the Lord, the King, that he's worthy to be adored. And what does this man say to Jesus? If you're willing, you can make me clean. He has no doubts that Jesus has the power to heal him of his illness and the authority to remove his uncleanness. He doesn't say to Jesus, you can heal me and then send me to a priest who will remove my uncleanness. He really believes that Jesus has the power and the authority to do both. The only question for him is whether Jesus is willing to do it. You can see in this man what real faith means. It means that you believe in Jesus himself, Jesus only, who he is, what he can do. You know that he has all power, all authority in his hands and in his voice. And you cast yourself on his mercy. And you appeal to him alone to rescue you. And you look to him for mercy. And you say what this man said, if you will, you can. And when Jesus sees that faith, Jesus responds. He says, I will. And his word is enough. Some of us remember the day when we first knelt before Jesus and said, if you will, you can take away my sins. And he said, I will. You're forgiven. Or we said, I'm soiled, I'm defiled, I'm unclean. If you will, you can make me clean. And he said, I will be clean. Some of us said, I've got a bad, selfish, proud heart. But if you will, you can make me a new person. And he said, I will. You're a new creature now. Some of us said, I'm so far from God. I'm cut off from him. But if you will, you can bring me back to God. And he said, I will. You're God's child now. Jesus speaks with total authority. His words are powerful. They're the words of God. Jesus speaks as God because he is God. And that is why when you read through the words of the Sermon on the Mount or any of the other words of Jesus, you know that you must believe them. You must put them into practice. You must build your life upon them like a man building his house on a rock. In the end, you can't be sure, 100% sure, of what anybody else says. Even the people you love best and trust most, your closest friend, your marriage partner, they can be mistaken. They can be confused. They can be misleading in what they say. But every word that Jesus speaks is true and trustworthy. A rock that we can build on for time and eternity. What's your life built on? What are your hopes built on? Where is your certainty? Where is your security? Jesus said, he who hears my words and does them is like a man who builds his house on the rock.